There is another aspect of the argument of Arjuna, which is not explicitly stated, but which is behind the whole argument. We have to bring that argument also in the forefront. And there is a still deeper question, what is action from the argument? As I told you, to examine an argument, you should know what it states, but also what it does not state. Sometimes what is not stated is known, but sometimes what is not stated is not even known. So my second point is regarding what is known but not stated. The third point is that it is not even known by Arjuna and therefore not stated. You have to sing and hell, we shall see later on because it's a long proposal. And I have to deal with this problem at a very deep level. So let us see if I can finish it today and jump to that problem. Otherwise when I come again, we shall take it up. But let us come to the second point. What is known to Arjuna, which is behind the whole argument, but which is not explicitly stated. Arjuna knows that he is a Kshatriya. This is a word, again a Sanskrit word, that must be understood. Kshatriya. As you know, Indian society was consciously organized. And in this organization, the society was fourfold. There were four holders of the society. And each individual of the society was supposed to belong to one of these four orders. And each order had a name. Kshatriya was one of the orders, and the other three orders were Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. So either one was a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, or a Shudra. And each one was supposed to be led to the highest if he followed the law of his own order. A Brahmin was one whose very natural inclination was to pursue knowledge. Kshatriya was one who by his very nature, would like to rule, would like to protect, and would like to fight for justice. Vaishya was one who by nature would like to accumulate, to exchange, to enrich by productivity, by cultivation, and by means of merchandise. Shudra was one who would like to serve, who would like to obey, who would like to submit automatically by his own nature. Everyone should have all the four. Everyone has all the four elements. But sometimes, or very often, in fact in general, human beings tend to have one of these four more prominent. So according to that prominence, he would be called Brahmin or Kshatriya or Vaishya or Shudra. So it was said that if a Brahmin pursues knowledge and also gives knowledge, then he can rise to the highest, namely who can read the divine. If the Kshatriya rules and rules properly, rightly, not merely for domination's sake, but rules properly, if he protects the weak and the oppressed, if he secures justice to the people, if he fights for justice, then he can read the highest. He can read the divine. A Vaishya is one, if he does the work of production, cultivation, of exchange, of accumulation and distribution, then we can also read the Supreme. And Shudra, even if he is not learned, even if he cannot rule, even if he cannot protect, even if he does not produce, but he simply gives his end as a servant, works even in the lowest kinds of activities, in the eyes of God there is no lowest activity. The people sometimes call them lowest activities, like sweeping the room, washing the clothes, various kinds of services which are rendered. So if he does these services, then he can also reach the highest. Now this was the idea of Indian society. Behind this activity, there were two supreme ideas in a society. One, money should not become the lord. This was a very powerful element in Indian social makeup. And secondly, there should be minimum of conflict. These are the two great ideals which were to be served by this kind of a formation of society. Minimum of conflict, no conflict. If conflict were all even there, there was to be a great restriction. Gandhi was not supposed to accumulate wealth. That was not his dharma. If he was in need of money, then a law was imposed that the ruler or the rich, Vaishya, should support him. So even if he had no money, his life would not be affected. So money does not become the lord. Basically, it was only Vaishya who was supposed to collect money, and he could become very rich, very powerful only because of money. But then it was laid down that his riches should be given to gurus. That was his dharma. If he only accumulated wealth, he was not a true Vaishya. A true Vaishya is one who earns and gives, and gives profusely. Even Kshatriya was not supposed to earn money. But because he protected the oppressed, because he served the weak, even by fighting for justice, he had the right to take the money from Vaishya. And Vaishya was supposed to support the king and the prince. So once again, money was not the lord. Similarly, for the sake of reduction of conflict in society, it was laid down that even though Kshatriya must fight, we must fight only after making utmost effort at peaceful settlement. That was his duty. It would not be as if whenever conflict arose, he immediately plunged into war and tried to settle everything by muscle power. He was required to see that all conflicts are resolved peacefully, amicably. It is only when you fail to do it, and when you find that if you do not fight, the weak will be trampled under the feet of the oppressor, then only you should raise your sword and fight. That was the dharma of the Kshatriya. As a result, the conflicts in society were minimum. Even though the life of Indian society was filled with wars, as you might have read, but the surprising fact is that Indian society, among all the nations of the world, this is the only society which had a continuous survival. This is the only society which has remained continuously linked with the utmost past. There is no other nation in the world which has such a long history and such an unbroken history. That means society could remain somehow united. Although mutants are sometimes very weak, sometimes very powerful, but still could survive. The secret of it was this. Money was not the lord, and conflicts were minimum. It is only when the foreign invasions became powerful that both these elements came into picture very powerfully. Money became very powerful, and conflicts began to be waged. Wars began to be waged without imposition of the law of harmonization. Since then, Indian society has become weaker and weaker and weaker. And now when we rise again, we have different systems. We are now thinking of restructuring. And you will see the two important words that mother has used in the dream. You must read the mother's small article called the dream. I don't know if you have seen it. One day you should see. It's a very short article. You have seen it?
Yes, sir.
You have seen it. A dream. You read again. Even if you have read it again before, doesn't matter. It requires to be read again and again 500 times, 1000 times. And you will see in this article of the mother, there are two very prominent factors which she has underlined. Money shall not be the lord. That is a powerful element in this particular document. And she says that the impulse to combat, the impulse to fight, the instinct to fight should be replaced by the impulse to do better. These two elements mother has again brought into the picture for the new world. If the today's world is very difficult to handle, it is needed this money power and violence. Men are simply violent in the nature, in the temperament. And they now comes to their own effect. If these two things are controlled, society can be more and more perfect. The Indian society had arranged these two things through this particular kind of a system. Surely it was not ideal, because so many loopholes were there in the system. Everybody did not follow all this system. And they could not find out the way by which this system can be worked fully and perfectly. He deteriorated, degenerated. All this is because the system was not ideal. Therefore, it is not proposed that we should go back to this kind of a formation. But we must appreciate what was good in it and how it helped the evolving society, and try to understand the truth behind it. And even in the reconstruction, the truth should be brought again back in another form. Like Sri Aurobindo has said, it is not possible now to go back to this system. But in the modern world, there is one very good tendency which has arisen. We should take advantage of it. All over the world, there is a movement towards what is called classless society. A society in which there are no classes. Classless society. A society in which there are no classes, no castes. As a result, everyone is supposed to do any work that comes in his hand. Now, sometimes it is very disadvantageous when wrong work comes in your hands because you are not fit for it. But the advantage is that you are obliged to develop a quality which you did not possess earlier. Your work demands a quality. If war breaks out, then everyone, whether he is a hero or not, whether he is a soldier or not, he is supposed to fight. Everyone. In India, early India, only Kshatriyas were allowed to fight. Others were not allowed. So even when the war broke, only Kshatriyas were allowed. Women were not allowed at all. But now, in the present world, if war breaks out, every citizen is supposed to join the army. And everyone has to participate in one way or the other in the war effort. So even if you are not meant for fighting, you have to develop the faculty of fighting. This is the demand of the modern world. Now this has disadvantage, but also advantage, that even if you do not have a capacity, you develop that capacity. So if you want to develop a new world, you take advantage of this system of classless society, where whatever work is given to you, you should be able to do. This can happen only if we develop the qualities of all. And this is Sri Aurobindo's proposal. He has spoken of fourfold personality. Everyone has to become Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Everyone. You develop your qualities to such an extent, Sri Aurobindo has said, a yogi can do any work that is given to him. Once Jivatma asked me a question, do you think Sri Aurobindo was a philosopher? Now Sri Aurobindo himself has written, I am not a philosopher, not a philosopher, not a philosopher. And yet I was teaching philosophy of Sri Aurobindo. So she asked me the question whether Sri Aurobindo was really a philosopher. Sri Aurobindo's answer to the question was that I am not a philosopher, yet I wrote philosophy and became the most reputed philosopher in the world. That is because of fourfold personality. Sri Aurobindo had developed fourfold personality. And he has written, a yogi, if he is asked to do something, he can do that work and marvelously and perfectly. If you read the small book called The Mother, I don't know if you have seen that book. Small book called The Mother. Have you seen it? Yes? There, it is written about the Divine Mother herself. And Sri Aurobindo said, fourfold personality of the mother. Isn't it? She was at once Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. It is a fourfold personality. If you read the description, you will find the supreme knowledge, the supreme power, that is Mahakali, supreme love, supreme power of exchange, supreme power of opulence, wealth, Mahalakshmi, and supreme power of perfection. Every little work, even the ground level, everything is perfect, which only Shudra can do. That is the ideal of a Shudra. Every little work, as Sri Aurobindo said, when all work is finished for Mahasaraswati, nothing remains forgotten. Nothing remains omitted. Everything is done. Everything is perfect. So that is the greatness and glory of the Shudra. That is Mahasaraswati. Shudra is the son of Mahasaraswati. So instead of thinking the Shudra is something low, no. In the eyes of God, there is nothing high, nothing low. Everything is a manifestation of the divine. So that is Sri Aurobindo's solution, that for the moral world, he developed every individual to develop Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. Every student should have all the four. That is why in the education system that we want to develop, we speak of integral education. All the four qualities, the four personalities should develop. So it's a very good program. Unless you do that, modern society cannot be built. If today modern society is suffering, it is because, while on one hand, you ask everybody to do any job, you are not providing that education by which one can do it. Therefore, education should be such that every individual gets all the aspects of his personality. And again, on the lines of his predominance, you should not impose upon the child. But ultimately, you grow in such a way that all the four faculties develop in him or in her. Now, this is the background I wanted to give, which is in the Bhagavad Gita, where very often you hear the word dharma or kshatriya. Because Arjuna was a kshatriya. And Arjuna, as a kshatriya, had come to the war because he knew very well what was the dharma of the kshatriya. The kshatriya, whenever there is injustice, he should come forward. He shouldn't say, this is not my job. I am not called upon. No. Even if you are not called upon, the moment you see injustice before your eyes, it is your function to protect the oppressed. You should work for the balancing of justice. You should not wait for being invited. It is your own dharma. It is your work. It is your breath of life. So Arjuna, when he saw there was so much of injustice being done by the Kauravas, they restrained themselves greatly. That was also part of dharma. Conflict should not be invited. If conflict is there, you should try your best to settle the conflict amicably. They had done everything for that purpose. Ultimately, they failed. So the only way out was now to fight. Arjuna was one of the principal actors in this trying to settle the battle without fighting. He had failed, and therefore a decision was taken jointly by all the Pandavas and all the friends of Pandavas that now fight is the only method of settling so as to secure justice. This was the decision. Therefore, in this argument that you read, although he doesn't say any time, I know that my dharma is a kshatriya's dharma and I must fight. This argument you don't find in these statements which I read out to you. He doesn't say, I know very well that I must fight. But if you read the whole argument, it is present every time. He knows that he has to fight. And yet when he finds he cannot fight, there is a reason. You see the conflict. He knows the dharma that he must fight. And yet the situation is such where he is constrained to say, I cannot fight, I will not fight. The dharma is categorical imperative. If you see the three things which I have given you yesterday, hedonism, utilitarianism, and the categorical imperative. Dharma is categorical imperative. Why should you fight? You must fight because that is a dharma. Whether you succeed or you don't succeed, it's not for success that you fight. It's your dharma to fight. It's not for consequences. We know very well that he has to fight. He has come here to fight. Some people who don't read Bhagavad Gita properly, they think that Arjuna forgot his dharma and he tried to escape, and then Sri Krishna came forward and said, look, you have forgotten your dharma. Then you remember and then join the war. This is a very simplistic argument. Arjuna did not forget his dharma. But he had now before him a new dharma presenting itself. And there is a clash of two dharmas. When he says, if I kill, I will commit sin. Because if I kill my ancestor, my grandfather, I am deviating from my origin. And if I kill the origin, it will be sin. It was another categorical imperative, do not kill your origin. So Kshatriya Dharma was also categorical imperative. Right? Because you are Kshatriya. Now comes before his eyes another categorical imperative, don't kill your origin. If you do so, it's a sin. The other arguments are minor arguments. The major argument is this, that if I kill my originator, I will commit sin. Now this sharpness of the conflict makes him paralyzed. When you should do one thing and you should do exactly the opposite, two contradictory things are demanded of you at the same time, what do you do? That's why Arjuna says, my mouth is parched. My limbs are quivering. The hair on my hand and my feet, they stand on end. Because of this great conflict of two dharmas, it is this conflict that Sri Krishna answers. So this is a very important argument, which you have to depict from all these words which are there. Why Arjuna is arguing so much? He had only one simple argument, I must fight, I am a Kshatriya. Why are we arguing, laboring so much? Because now he is confronted with a situation with other ideas arise in the mind, which are in conflict with the dharma. It showed that even the system was not capable of answering the question. If you follow the system, answer was very clear to him. So Sri Krishna even says, don't bother about the system. If you see the whole of the Bhagavad Gita at the end, you will find Sri Krishna saying, do not worry about this system. There is something still higher. When the two dharmas conflict, there is something else to be done. that something else was not in the view of Arjuna at all. It's a third element in the whole argument. When two dharmas collide, what must be the solution? Both are good dharmas, both are correct dharmas. It was not as if dharma was known to him and he forget it, and now he had to be reminded of it. Sri Krishna's answer is not that, look, you are a kshatriya, therefore you must fight. That is not his answer. Although, at certain times he speaks about it also. But that is not his final answer. His answer is, these all dharmas. When dharmas collide, he says, give up all dharmas. And that which is not known to you now, which you are not even referring to, which you must refer to actually, if you want a solution to the problem, is the divine swarup. Now you see the whole argument, the word divine does not appear. You read the whole argument, the word divine does not appear at all in the whole argument. He doesn't speak of the divine's will at all. And yet he speaks a language of a very wise man. Therefore, when Sri Krishna begins the answer, it's very nice to read the answer that Sri Krishna gives, at least the first few words. If you want to read the whole thing, it will come later on, but even the first few words are very, very important. He says, Sri Krishna says, this is the 11th verse in the 2nd chapter. He says, thou grievest for those who should not be grieved for, and yet speakest wise seeming words. You speak as if you are very wise. But the enlightened man does not mourn either for the living or for the dead. He puts up a new proposition. And then as he expounds further, he says, you forget, which the wise man never forget, that there is immortality. In your whole argument, you are only playing, killing, dying. But look, the wise men are aware of the immortal. In your whole argument, there is no reference to immortality at all. Because you are not referring to the immortality and the consequences of immortality, if you know that there is immortal even in the death, that even when the death occurs, the immortal does not die, then the whole consequence will be different. Argument will change. It's a new element that Sri Krishna introduces in the argument. So now let us recapitulate. Arjuna's argument has three elements. One is that he brings out arguments which are based upon hedonism, based upon utilitarianism, and based upon the categorical imperative. There are three elements you have seen. Which argument is what? The argument of sin is the argument of categorical imperative. The argument when he says, I am not pleased, that is hedonistic argument. When he says that I cannot enjoy properly because the people with whom I have to share, they will no more be there, it is utilitarian argument. All the three arguments also are in collision with each other. If you take one and not the others, then also there would have been a solution. But all the three arguments are put together and they are in collision. They are themselves in conflict. There is not one standard by which he is arguing. Three standards, all pell mell put together. Therefore the argument is a confused argument. It's confusion in the argument. So that is one part which you can see very easily. There is another part which is behind it, which he knows, but which is not explicitly stated. That is, he should have said, I know that I am a Kshatriya and I must fight. And that is my dharma. But it is implied in the whole argument that is present. The very fact is laboring to put up a separate point of view is because behind him is this knowledge that he has come here to fight. It is his dharma to fight, and yet because of the presence of other arguments which have just come up on his mind at that time, and since he cannot reconcile at least the two categorical imperatives, one according to which you must fight, the dharma of fighting, the other, do not kill the originator of your own self, because that will be a sin. So do not commit sin is another categorical imperative. The two categorical imperatives are in conflict. The third element, which I said, is not even in mind of Arjuna. And if that was in the mind of Arjuna, the whole conflict could have been resolved by himself. Therefore, he is not in the picture at all. That argument is absent. It does not refer to the idea of immortality. He does not refer to the idea of the divine's will. So it's absent in the whole argument, that is absent. What Sri Krishna brings forth in answering the question was, first to establish the idea of immortality and bring out the consequences of the idea of immortality. If soul is immortal, so that even when the body is killed, the soul is immortal, what are the consequences of that proposition? Philosophically, it's a very important statement. Secondly, all the time Arjuna speaks of his idea, of his will, what I think, what will please me, he does not refer to what will please the divine. What is his will? Therefore, Sri Krishna says, your problem can be resolved only if you go beyond these two categorical imperatives which are in conflict with each other and arrive at the will of the divine. It is said that Bhagavad Gita is a great book of Karma Yoga. And I told you what is Karma Yoga. So let us revise it. Karma Yoga has an aim, there is instrument, and then there is the method. Alright. The aim, instrument and method or process. Now the aim is, in Karma Yoga, the aim is the discovery of the divine will. We have said that Jnana Yoga aims at the discovery of the divine knowledge. Karma Yoga is a discovery of the divine will. Jnana Yoga is a discovery of the divine knowledge and divine being. This is divine will. The divine being is the aim of the Jnana Yoga. And Bhakti Yoga, what is the aim? To enjoy, to discover the joy, the love of the divine. Now this book is basically a book of Karma Yoga, although it is also Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. But primarily it is prominently the Karma Yoga, the greatest gospel of Karma Yoga, as known to the ancients, has been described in the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, if anybody asks you what is Karma Yoga, best exposition of it, it is in the Bhagavad Gita. What is the instrument of Karma Yoga? Instrument is desire and will. And then comes the process. The process which I told you is actually described in the Bhagavad Gita very, very fully. First, give up the desire for the enjoyment of the fruits of action. Secondly, renounce the idea that you are the doer of action. Do not be like the dog under the cart. Right? Give up the idea that you are the doer of action. Then, yoga is a discovery of the divine knowledge and divine being. This is divine will. The divine being is the aim of the Jnana Yoga. And Bhakti Yoga, what is the aim? To enjoy, to discover the joy, the love of the divine. Now this book is basically a book of Karma Yoga, although it is also Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. But primarily it is prominently the Karma Yoga, the greatest gospel of Karma Yoga, as known to the ancients, has been described in the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, if anybody asks you what is Karma Yoga, best exposition of it is in the Bhagavad Gita. What is the instrument of Karma Yoga? Instrument is desire and will. And then comes the process. The process which I told you is actually described in the Bhagavad Gita very, very fully. First, give up the desire for the enjoyment of the fruits of action. Secondly, renounce the idea that you are the doer of action. Do not be like the dog under the cart. Right? Give up the idea that you are the doer of action. Then, third is offer your actions to the divine. And fourth is allow the divine's will to manifest to you without obstruction. Right? This is the process that Sri Krishna explains to Arjuna, and all the other chapters from 2nd chapter to 18th chapter is a description of this process. When we have time, we shall do the whole of the Bhagavad Gita one day. It's one of the greatest gospels of Karma Yoga. Very often people say, why should I act in the world at all? Even in our world there is a question, there are people who do not see why one should be working. I was very surprised when I heard that people in our world, some of the people do not want to work. If they read the Bhagavad Gita, to remain without work itself would be a terrible blow. Not for anybody's sake. Categorical is more than categorical imperative. That you must work is more than categorical imperative. It is the divine's will. So once you know this, it will be impossible for you to remain without working. Sri Krishna, in fact, there is a great statement made in the Ishopanishad that you should continuously go on working. And you should desire at least for 100 years to be gone working. And yet when you work, you are free from work. It doesn't burden you. You should not say, oh, I have too much work, I am burdened, grumble about it, I want to reduce it. No, you want to increase the capacity of work. So now we have seen the whole argument in totality. It's not like 12 now. I wanted to deal with that question of sin and hell. So you have to wait a little. Alright? When I come again, you raise this question when I come, we shall deal with that question. Alright, then we shall go back to the life divine and synthesis of yoga. Alright. I'll try to come back by the middle of October. Alright. Thank you.